Welcome to this archived LDN Research Trust conference presentation. We hope you enjoy it.
Well, I'm going to talk about LDN and cancer, and I'm coming from a very different way of doing things. I was trained in, I did some of my research at the Institute of Cancer Research, where you basically design drugs, put them in mice, other animals, and then you try phase one trials in humans. And I'm just going to give you a bit of my experience, where it's really quite the opposite way around, is that I came across LDN by a completely different... I think this is a...
It's gone back, sorry.
Right, that's it. Larger writing so I can read it. Now, I came from a different way, and that is I was dealing with melanoma patients, and I had a patient who was doing incredibly well, and we didn't have the drugs that we had at the time. This is, well, it was 13, 14 years ago now. And I was just quite amazed, and I'm quite nosy, and I kept saying, you're taking something, and I don't know about it. And eventually, she confessed that she was taking this drug, low-dose naltrexone, and I said, what's that? Apart from naltrexone, I knew it's an anti-opiate, but what's the low dose? I'd never heard of it before. And she explained to me that she had friends in New York that went to Dr. Bahari there, and they'd received low-dose naltrexone for various things, and that it worked. And I said, well, how does it work? And I didn't know, but Dr. Zagon's name was mentioned. And so I had a look at a couple of the papers, because they are published. And I showed an interest, and so next time I went to New York, she insisted I went to Bahari's clinic. So I went through the clinic, and I went through all his notes. It was a card system, it's not computers like today. And the cancer notes were absolutely confusing. I couldn't possibly come to a conclusion or a decision at all. And I believe that somebody went on behalf of the NCI and did something rather similar and came away also a bit confused. But the message for multiple sclerosis was very clear. And there appeared to be a really whole host of patients who had stopped progressing after they'd gone on low-dose naltrexone. Anyhow, then there was another patient came who was also doing incredibly well. This patient actually had breast cancer, with widespread breast cancer metastasis. And the history showed that they had basically frozen and stopped progressing. And this patient also admitted to that this coincided with going to New York and taking low-dose naltrexone with from Dr. Bahari. So I was very, very interested in this. So we started to look at giving low-dose naltrexone to patients who are in that period where they've come off chemotherapy, they can't take chemotherapy anymore, and it's too early really for palliative care. So they're in that area, and I was really impressed with patients with melanoma liver mets, and then for other liver mets who are no longer able to take chemotherapy but seem to stabilize on the low-dose naltrexone. And this was really first brought to my attention by my secretary, who was saying that they're wanting another repeat. And that's how we started to notice that the patients were doing very well just on the low-dose naltrexone. And some of them even referred to it as happy pills. So when you've got cancer heading to palliative care, to have something that makes you feel better and a better outlook in life, from my point of view, that is well worth considering as part of the management. Now, I'm just going to go through cases because this is not something I developed and took through to the clinic, but the other way, just rather astounded at my clinical experience. One girl here who really did impress me is a 27-year-old girl with melanoma who, when I was looking at the various treatments that we were using, also had Crohn's disease and required increasing steroids and anti-TNF, and it was clear that this treatment was interfering with the melanoma because she started to get metastatic disease. And I'd been aware from my researches in with Dr. Bahari that it was also active in Crohn's disease. So I thought for the melanoma and Crohn's, perhaps we could try and switch to LDN. And this was quite remarkable because she said within 48 hours of starting the LDN, it was the first time she'd woken up in the morning without having to address the problems of the diarrhea. And the whole time I looked after her, she basically was able to come off the anti-TNF and stabilize the melanoma. Unfortunately, it just reduced the inevitable. In retrospect, we started probably the LDN far too late. But another index case, and I'm a great believer of the well-observed anecdotes, which have actually went out of fashion 2 or 3 decades ago when I started doing clinical research. People said it was just for the fairies. You had to have large randomized controlled trials, otherwise you wouldn't learn anything. Well, I disagree, and this fellow here is a 70-year-old man with a head and neck melanoma. He went on one of my non-specific vaccine studies, then he got increased metastasized in his head and neck. It was a head and neck melanoma. They usually progress within 6 months, a year. So the fact he did 4 years was very good for the vaccine treatment. But when he progressed, he refused chemo. He was a GP. But he did agree to accept low-dose naltrexone. So he took the low-dose naltrexone, and when I saw him, it was 2 or 3 weeks later, I asked him how he felt on it, whether it was going to do him any good, and he said, "Look at me, it's a bloody disaster." He said, took his shirt off to reveal vitiligo. Well, vitiligo is white patches you get, and if you're in the melanoma field, to induce, have a treatment with a vaccine that induces vitiligo, you know that patient is going to do very well, because you've induced highly specific cytotoxic T killer cells against the tyrosinase, which is the major constituent of the melanoma. Anyhow, he was very upset by this, but he's still here. That's over 10 years later. I mean, it's quite incredible. He no longer moans about the vitiligo, however. So, back this way. This one's not going. There we go. So the LDN induced specific CTLs which did not activate with the previous vaccine, which is fascinating. The fact he seemed to be controlled, that vaccine boosts the innate immune response greatly, but you usually get CTLs, cytotoxic T cells, induced if they exist there, but they're dormant and sleeping. And essentially, the LDN was able to do something that activated these cells that were dormant. This, by the way, is the mechanism of these checkpoint inhibitors that you hear so much about, the ipilimumab and the pembro and the nivo. What they do, they take the brakes off the system. They don't make a new vaccine for your system. Basically, we now know that there are T cells there which will attack your cancer, but they've been suppressed, and I'm going to come to that in a few minutes. But this was essentially, we decided that this change was difficult to explain just with modulation of the opiate receptors. It could be, I accepted that, it could be, I didn't fully understand the opiate receptors and their role in the immune system, but I decided that there had to be another mechanism of action. And I had worked with other things. I will actually give you some background very briefly as to why I asked. Now, naltrexone, specifically designed to be a high affinity interactor with the opiate receptor, could it also act with something else? Because as Stephen so rightly said, there's no drug that has one clear action, and we have got to know that very well. I'll just step back a little bit because I was going to start looking for a receptor that we didn't know existed. And I had a history, I discovered the CD4 molecule, the receptor for the HIV virus, in the very early days of HIV research. And we did this by developing screens. Once we could tell the virus interacted with a cell, we developed screens where we used just literally hundreds of antibodies to see if any of them would prevent the interaction and infection of the cell. And all the ones with CD4 properties blocked the activation and entry of the virus. So I decided that we would try and use the same approach for the low-dose naltrexone. So we went looking around for all the assays for all the different immune receptors, which did include the toll-like receptors. And one thing I would disagree with Stephen on was that it is in the literature about TLR4, but what we came up with, and we couldn't repeat the 4 story at all, but we came up with TLR9, and I'll come to that in a minute. There we go. I just mentioned the HIV thing for a minute, because even when you get a very, very clear receptor interaction, I use this as a biological demonstration of just how complex disease in the immune system is that we found that if you look at this chart here, you can see that the blue represents the CD4 cells, and then the red, the virus load, and the conditions, you see a very nice fall off in the CD4 cells and a rise in the virus load and the conditions. And that was initially thought to be a lovely explanation for the CD4 receptor. The virus enters via the CD4 receptor, kills all the CD4 cells, and then you have no immune system. Actual fact, we found that if anything, this was very, very, very simplified, oversimplistic. In fact, that the disease, and if this is now accepted, is really one of activation. So that HIV induces a chronic activation of the immune system, and it's the chronic activation which acts like a noise and drowns out the specific signals, and that's what causes the disease. And we found, and Jean Shearer mentioned in America, that the disease was very, very similar to graft versus host disease. I don't want to get into this, but it's a disease of just overwhelming activation of the immune system, so it no longer works. And we think that that is the mechanism, and that the mechanism is due to another receptor which wasn't very well defined at the time. Now, why am I saying this? Because it actually gave us some insight into what was going on in cancer. Because we knew in cancer, that Jean Shearer, who works at the National Cancer Institute, had shown several different cancers that there was an immune suppression going on, which you could detect just taking lymphocytes from the arm. Not as marked as in HIV, but it was in cancer. So this is the classic National Cancer Institute progression of a cancer. And I have a pointer here. And basically, where one change leads to the cell surviving and not dying, another change will lead to it growing bigger and better, another one will allow it to really get ripping, and then another few, and they get out of control, and you develop a cancer. And basically, out of the work that I've just been talking about, with the first of the HIV, the particular receptor, and the fact that that particular receptor interaction doesn't account for the disease at all, we started to look, this is a friend, Ken O'Byrne, and I realized that what was going on as cancer developed was that they were developing in an area of chronic inflammation with all the growth factors that are required for angiogenesis and the suppressed immune suppression that you get with this chronic inflammation allows the initiation cell to escape the CTL killers, which we know are there now. We can give these checkpoint inhibitors and that, but they can't see the tumor, which is why a lot of the checkpoints don't work. And just to put this into context, we are able to show, this is one of the very few little bits of science I'm going to show you, but this is so clear. We measured the immune response here for producing interferon gamma from patients with colorectal cancer before the surgery. These are controls, non-cancer bowel surgery, and this is the patients a month afterwards, i.e. they'd all come back to normal. So the only conclusion of that is the colon cancer caused immune suppression, which we could measure very easily, and it came back. There's a slight twist to that. Oh dear, what do I press there now? There you go. There's a slight twist to that. Anyhow, that's data showing that the more the patient came back to normal, the longer they lived. And we went on to realize that with this, there was a balance of the immune system. And this is where we're coming back to low-dose naltrexone. It's so important. There's a balance between the cell-mediated and the humoral response, and that they balance each other up. And if you perturbate them, they come back, rather like the Lorentz attractor, which is one of the seminal components of nonlinear mathematics, how things can repeat time and time again, never go exactly the same way. It's nonlinear, but very consistent, reliable around these attractors. Now, in disease, and both HIV, chronic disease, and cancer, this cell-mediated response is suppressed, and the humoral is increased. And what we found was that you can correct that by removing cancer. You cannot correct it in diseases where you can't remove all the cancer, so you're dealing with that. And that brings me to the other work that we were involved in very early on. And this is another case of seeing patients improve with a drug that was said to be absolutely awful, thalidomide. Now, thalidomide, which comes in left and right, it's very interesting because the left is good and the right is bad. I think it's that way around, isn't it? And I was very interested in the patient who responded fantastic to thalidomide for, who couldn't respond to steroids. I mean, basically, it was a very, very bad form of Behçet's disease with a vasculitis and everything. They absolutely cured by thalidomide, even though that had been intensive care, completely steroid resistant. And I wrote an article saying, this drug's fantastic. We must resurrect and do something about it. And a fellow replied to this article, a chap called Steve Thomas, who used to work for Chiral, who said he spent ages making the thalidomide the left drug, and in order to avoid the right, that was the bad bit, but as soon as you put it into the human, the liver flicked it over to the right. So that was obviously not the way, but the good bits of thalidomide were so good that it suggested we did another way, and that is just make analogues. Well, the first of these analogues, lenalidomide, is one of the, I think it was the second biggest selling drug of the in oncology last year for myeloma, lymphoma, and that's how he started of it. Now, what was interesting is we had no idea how these drugs worked in the receptors. In fact, the only one that they really thought that would work on was anti-TNF, and I don't need the one there on the left. This was the mechanism of action. What I'm putting this up to say is, especially when we're talking about specific receptors, we really don't have a clue with regards which is the most important because there's so many. And now it's been beautifully elucidated how it does all this. Thalidomide sticks into a thing called cereblon, and that alters the way the other part that doesn't stick in interacts with cascade signaling pathways, which gives it the reason why it's been so effective in so many conditions. Now, why have I spent all this time telling about these things? Because this set the template for me understanding the low-dose naltrexone. Low-dose naltrexone is clearly doing something. It's not just as simple as an opiate receptor. There's massive knock-ons. And so this is why we went looking. Let's just show how effective lenalidomide is. So with the receptors, we screened all these receptors, and we hit upon a positive hit. The screen produced a very strong signal to TLR9, toll-like receptor 9, not 4 as previously reported, and we spent ages trying to get a signal on 4, and the result was the paper spent ages trying to get a reviewer that didn't block it because they worked on TLR4, and we finally got it in Frontiers Immunology, and what is important to see is that the toll-like receptors 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 are external cell membrane-based, and these are the ones that our vaccines work on. These toll-like receptors 7, 8, 9 are normally internal receptors, but they are overexpressed in certain conditions. Now, TLR9, and here is the basic data. It's in the morning, and it's very, very hot in here, and very hot in Glasgow, so I don't expect you to go over this. I'll just tell you what it shows. But just to show us, we did very fine, very didactic experiments. We repeated them many times. We did all sorts of controls. But it is TLR9, which is affected. We looked at the inhibition of the IL-6 production, which was a very, very strong inhibition through the TLR9. It's mentioned there. The paper that shows all these cytokines and inflammatory cytokines increase. No effect was seen at all for TLR4, and no effect was seen for IL-1, which shares the main TLR signaling system. And we are able to show the inhibition of these cytokines. I'm not going to go through the details again, but just to point out that here we were able to show that there was a complete inhibition with anti-TLR9, but not with TLR4. This is all published, so I'm not going to go through it further in detail. And also to point out that we looked at naltrexone does not reduce the overall cell viability on peripheral blood mononuclear cells at all. So it's acting through the signaling, and it's not actually having any particular effect on its survival. Now, why was TLR9 very interesting for me? Because this is a highly reproducible. We did it through many different techniques. We also sent it out to other laboratories, blindly, and they were able to get this back because I was so worried about the TLR4 being out there. So we know this is very, very important. So TLR9 for me, why is it important? It is important because the girl I had with the Crohn's disease who responded within 48 hours, we now know TLR9 is grossly overexpressed in Crohn's disease and actually psoriasis. Fascinating, I've had patients with psoriasis, unbelievable response. And I think that's due to the fact that it's a TLR9. And the other thing, it's overexpressed in several tumor types, including pancreas and gliomas. And there are several reports, as you know, out there of improvements in pancreatic cancer to low-dose naltrexone. But it is also important in dendritic cell activation and antigen expression. Now, just really push it very carefully, is this TLR9, I was expecting it to be an agonist. No, our data was entirely antagonist. But it is interestingly, because I studied that immune modulation and we had the complicated mechanisms of action of an HIV and known receptors, and it doesn't explain, doesn't work out like that. And then we had the wonderful examples from thalidomide showing just how amazing that drug is at correcting the immune system. In fact, we call those drugs immodulators specifically. And I think low-dose naltrexone is actually an immune modulator. And it probably, and we haven't got the data yet, I'm only allowed to present stuff that I've published. But I think the dendritic cell thing is affected by low-dose naltrexone, and Zagon's data would be consistent with that. So you really have a new modulator. Anything that's overexpressing TLR9 is brought down, and anything underexpressing it for the antigen presentation is brought up. That's my current thinking. Now, I'm just going to... they play a fundamental role in the immune system. I'm just going to go on to one last little bit of lab data, because I was very, very concerned that low-dose naltrexone amongst the doctors, etc., they've either never heard of it, or even one of my best friends, who's a neurologist and has multiple sclerosis patients on it, is so cynical about it that I thought we really got to bring as much science into it as we possibly can. And this one was work done by Wei Liu, who's my senior postdoctoral fellows, and has particular interest in this and the cannabinoids, which I notice is also out there, but I'm not going to talk about this. He was basically involved with doing gene chipping for drugs. And I said, that's fascinating. So, see what you show. And basically, you get these genes expressed, and you can put them in a Venn diagram. And what he was looking at is tumor cell lines before and after cytotoxic drugs were added, as which pathways do they affect? Like, say, BRAF inhibitors turn off the BRAF, et cetera, et cetera. So I said to him, if you've got some more chips, perhaps we could look at the expression of low-dose naltrexone and normal-dose naltrexone and see if there's a difference. And that basically is exactly what we found. We found the genes that there's an overlap, but it's the minority, but there is a tremendous number of unique genes which are expressed by low-dose naltrexone, which then switched off as you raise the dose. And once again, we've done this ad nauseum, and the interesting genes in the top 10 are completely reproducible with the low dose, they're switched on, and then as you take the dose up, they're switched off. And these have unique ones on the cell cycle and the immune system. So this actually is very in keeping with what I think is an immune modulator. All this is just wonderful work. You can go to it, it's all published. And we're looking through all the cell pathways, cell cycle perturbations, and finding some very, very interesting observations. And one of them, which we've done, is actually even better for the cannabinoids, is that the cell death is better on withdrawal. And this has led to a lot of discussions, which I like to do the discussion, is with low-dose naltrexone, coming to an end in a minute, how do we actually use these drugs? We think that the cell death induced by cannabinoids is so strong that it should be used intermittently. This has been suggested too for low-dose naltrexone, which we've shown here in the washout, but I think that, and this is where I really like to have a, you know, we're all here to have a discussion about it. I think that low-dose naltrexone given daily is very intermittent because it has such a rapid washout period. So you're basically only exposing the patient for a few hours. And so I'd like to discuss that further. It's one of the great things about having these meetings. I would just like to end on a couple of other more recent patients, and just to say that I've been very, very impressed with glioma patients who I've been seeing because they've progressed on radiotherapy and temozolomide. In fact, I don't do gliomas in the NHS, so melanoma is what they've given me to do. But I was rather horrified to find a close cousin and a friend of a friend and a colleague at work all developed gliomas in a very short time, to realise just how little progression has been made in this field in the last 30 years. And with their LDN, and the other thing I wanted to really emphasise here is you had it on your list too, and I've asked you, talking to Stephen here, is the importance of vitamin D. And the number of patients I see with cancer who've got low vitamin D, and we know that vitamin D, we did these experiments ages ago. You need vitamin D in all our cancer experiments in order to get any significant killing, and you need vitamin D to get any kind of immune system to work. So we always do the vitamin D, low-dose naltrexone, and we did some of these other drugs, metformin, because it's an mTOR inhibitor, and that pathway is very important in gliomas. And I'm just amazed that some of these patients have improved. This one here has improved dramatically in all areas after just putting them on this treatment without having any other so-called conventional treatment. So it's a signal, several patients than that. So this is the end of my talk. So in summary, LDN has direct and indirect activity in cancer, different effects on cancer cell lines. The gene expression, to me, means it is a, I've claimed it's a new clinical entity because of the gene expression at low dose. This is completely different from the high doses. It has indirect activity in inflammation and antigen presentation, and it acts as an immune modulator as well as being an antagonist of TLR9. That's my last slide, and yes, according to this, I'm on time. And I really want to thank Wei Liu and Kathy Scott, who did all the work. I mean, I flashed through those presentations because I know it's really hot and it's a Saturday in Glasgow. But it's all published and it's all been through peer review. And I think that the gene expression work and all the withdrawal work that Wei Liu and Kathy Scott did, who actually also did something I haven't shown here, they also showed that the cannabis preparations radiosensitized the gliomas, which is wonderful, but it wasn't part of the LDN. But they are really, really fantastic operatives. And Rachel Kant and Rachel Allen, who did all the TLR studies with me, did every which way we could to show a TLR interaction, and so that result is really real. And to the ICVI, formerly the Cancer Vaccine Institute, for funding and to try and protect the work so we can continue with it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this presentation. All past conference presentations can be found on our website, www.ldnresearchtrust.org.